Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. With the primary election behind us, candidates now look ahead to the general and collect endorsements along the campaign trail. We'll speak with Congressman Chris Pappas. Also, students went back to school this week, sometimes remotely, sometimes not, and we'll remember former Governor Steve Merrill, who died last weekend. These and other stories made waves across the Granite State this week, and we're going to break them down for you today on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And with us now, Congressman Chris Pappas. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Peter. It's nice to see you.
And listeners, as we enter this general election campaign season, what questions do you have for Congressman Pappas? Call us now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Congressman Pappas, you're running for a second term in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. So what are your, we'll say, top two reasons for running again?
Well, these are extraordinary times. And this work is personal for me because it's about the people I know all across New Hampshire. And as I've continued to stay in touch and listen to people in my district these past few months, I know that the health and economic security of Granite Staters is got to be front and center moving forward. We have got to make sure we stay ahead of this virus. We do all we can to keep our numbers low and make sure that we're throwing our workers, our small businesses, our communities, the financial lifeline that they need to weather this storm. So we have more work to do both before this election, over the next couple months, to get a meaningful deal done that can deliver additional relief. But we also have to look long-term about how we protect the health of Granite Staters and make sure we get our economy up and running again. Look, I fundamentally believe that we're all in this together. I think we see that through this pandemic. And we've got to look for policies and leaders who can bring us together, who can lower the temperature in the room, make sure that we're hearing each other out, and ensuring that we can move forward together. And I believe I have done that for the last 2 years, and I look forward to continuing to serve the people of New Hampshire moving forward at such a crucial moment.
You mentioned health and economic security as being your priorities here. And you also mentioned long-term, not just the short-term, but long-term efforts in those two arenas. Can you speak to the long-term efforts perhaps on the health front? What Congress should be doing to prepare the country over the long haul in providing that, what you call economic, or rather health security?
Well, we need additional support today that can continue to build out testing, treatment, and tracing. We passed a bill 4 months ago in the House. The Senate told us we needed to take a pause. And unfortunately, we haven't seen any major relief done that could build out public health efforts, scale up our efforts to deliver a vaccine once it's safe to each and every American who needs it. But beyond that, we have to look for ways to ensure that every American is covered, that healthcare is truly a right in this country. We have to focus on lowering costs. I had a Zoom house party with some independent and Republican voters the other night, and the biggest topic of conversation was out-of-pocket costs for health insurance, pre-existing conditions, and the cost of prescription drugs. So I've supported major legislation that would allow Medicare to negotiate lower costs of prescription drugs for all Americans. I believe that we should stop the political assault that's underway on the Affordable Care Act today. The administration is in court, and my opponent supports those efforts to take away healthcare from tens of millions of Americans in the middle of a pandemic. And that would jeopardize the protections that 571,000 Granite Staters have for their pre-existing conditions. So we've got to look at the whole health of the individual and our communities. And I believe I've supported policies and will continue to do so to do that. With respect to our economy, it's about ensuring that no one's left behind. We know that in the Great Recession, the burden was borne by our working families that are lower wage earners. We've got to make sure as well that our small businesses have what they need to stay afloat. So many have been innovating, they've been adapting, figuring out how to serve their customers in the early months of this pandemic. but the winter is going to be really mixed for them. They're concerned about what a second spike might mean to their small business, whether they'll be able to keep their doors open. And we know that these local businesses are what drive our economy here in New Hampshire. So additional relief is warranted, but also we have to look at the tax code and ways that we can support both these businesses to retain employees, but also weather the storm and come out stronger on the other side.
Well, let me ask you about tax policy, because the government's been spending a lot of money to help people who have found themselves unemployed during the pandemic. Government's also been helping businesses stay afloat so that they can come out of the pandemic on the other side. How should the government be paying for this? Should taxes be raised on the wealthy? Or is there another way that you would imagine paying for all this spending that the government's doing?
Well, we certainly have to make sure that our fiscal house is in order. And it has been years and years where both parties, frankly, haven't been paying close attention to this. The time where we can bring things into balance is when the economy is growing. Unfortunately, the last time we had that opportunity, Republicans in Congress gave a massive tax cut to the biggest corporations and wealthiest Americans. They spent trillions of dollars of our tax money when the economy was growing. And right now they're hassling us over a few hundred dollars to workers who are out of a job or support for our community health centers or hospitals, the things that we need to keep our communities afloat. So look, we've got to look at these as one-time expenses. By providing some support today, we can ensure that someone doesn't become chronically unemployed. We can ensure a business doesn't go bankrupt. It's better for our economy in the long run. Mm-hmm. So Fed has advised us to take extraordinary action. I believe we have to continue to do that. And when the economy begins to grow, that's when we can have the conversation about how we can create a fair tax system, how we can ensure that the wealthy are paying their fair share, and ensure that everyone can enjoy the opportunities that this country has to offer.
So for voters looking ahead to that moment and thinking you might be in office at that time, what might they expect from you as far as a remedy for perhaps the spending that's been happening? Is there a thing you can point to that you would like to change about perhaps the tax code or the way the government takes in money that it's been spending a lot of right now?
Well, I think we have to look at that 2017 tax cut bill, which gave so much support to those at the top who didn't need it.
Reversing that tax cut?
I think we can't raise taxes on the middle class, our working families, our small businesses. But for those who are doing well, for those big corporations who really have zero tax liability today, they need to be paying their fair share.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you have questions for Congressman Pappas, give us a call now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. And we have this question from Murphy, who sent us an email. Murphy asks, I was wondering if you could ask him for his thoughts on the stress, both from a health perspective and a budget perspective, on schools and local governments with school reopenings. Does Congress have a role in that, Congressman Pappas?
We absolutely do. And I had supported $100 billion in the HEROES Act back in May that would have distributed funding to local districts. I've heard this all over our state. I was in Summersworth recently talking to the mayor, local leaders, and the superintendent about the cost that they've been incurring to safely get education back up and running. They're in a remote situation now, which has a great deal of cost with respect to technology. And when you look at some of our districts in New Hampshire, they've been underfunded chronically over a period of years. And now they're asked to deal with cost to make sure that we can have remote learning or a very safe in-person environment. Some of them don't have the facilities and the ventilation to be able to have that kind of safe in-person environment. So the costs are extraordinary. So we've got to get some aid out to our communities as soon as possible to make sure that they can deal with these costs, to ensure that there aren't cuts to things like education, public safety, public health. And that's why not only am I supporting direct support to our schools, but also to cities and towns that are feeling the pinch in terms of their budgets. We don't want to put them in a tough position where they're having to make tough cuts or even raise taxes in the middle of a pandemic.
I see. Listeners, again, 1-800-892-6477. If you've got questions for Congressman Pappas, we get an email from Jeff in Manchester who asks, with colleges coming back, we saw high turnout in college towns in this week's elections. What else can we do to make it more accessible for young people to vote?
Well, I think it's important that everyone has the ability to vote. One of the great things we saw on Tuesday was a record turnout in a state primary, but also a very smooth process, both in terms of the absentee voting and the in-person voting experience. And you've got to give a lot of credit to our state and local officials for doing that under extraordinary circumstances. So I think our election officials are ready for November. They're ready to allow people to safely vote from home, which is great. We want to make sure that everyone, especially our young people, who too often are marginalized when it comes to the conversation around elections, that they feel empowered to get out. And really, voting is habit forming. When you do it at a young age, you're much more likely to do it throughout your life. Recently, I introduced a bill called the Youth Vote Protection Act, which is a pretty simple idea. It looks at the 26th Amendment to our Constitution that guarantees the right to vote for any citizen who's 18 years of age or older. It looks to identify certain roadblocks that have been put up by state legislatures or state and local governments, policies like moving polling places or requiring students to jump through extra hoops, to identify those and look to mitigate any damage to young people. So I think we've got to be on our toes about voter suppression efforts against all sorts of groups, including minority groups. And I hope we can move that legislation forward as well as pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and make sure that everyone across this country has the ability to get out and vote. So I'm hopeful that with some additional support to our states and municipalities, we'll have a very safe voting experience and every vote's going to count in November.
This week, the Manchester Police Patrolmen's Association and the Manchester Association of Police Supervisors announced their support for Matt Maurers, who won the Republican nomination this week to oppose you in the general election. These two police groups endorsed you last time around, but they said now that you've, quote, changed. What's your response to that?
Well, I stand with our law enforcement across New Hampshire, and they're doing an incredible job at keeping our community safe. When you think of everything that's been laid at their feet from not just this pandemic, but the addiction crisis, homelessness, mental health issues, they do a great job at providing public safety. And I've been fighting for additional funding. I'm the only candidate in this race that supports the kind of state and local funding that can protect the jobs of our law enforcement officials. I've also had some really constructive conversations with members of law enforcement. And one of the ideas that was generated out of those conversations is a bill I introduced to create a new grant program that would allow more local departments in New Hampshire to get accredited. I think one of the ideas from law enforcement is that we can institute best practices, improve standards and professionalism by going through this accreditation process. It's not recreating the wheel. There are some great solutions out there through a group called CALEA, which is one of the national accreditation entities. And I think if more departments could go through that, we could see the type of progress that we need to realize. So I'm continuing to communicate with all members of law enforcement, and I look forward to working with them well into the future. I think they have an important voice in this conversation, and I've really been encouraged by the balanced conversations we've seen happening here in New Hampshire, between not just law enforcement, but some of the folks who are leading the protests and who are rightly recognizing the institutional racism that exists in our country in a host of different ways across our society. So it's been a positive, constructive conversation here, and I hope that will continue.
So you disagree with their assessment that you've changed?
Look, I've been working with them consistently, and you know, while they might not like some of the votes that I've taken, including for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, I think it's important that we have this conversation about how we can move our country forward. We can address some of the incidences of violence across this country and make sure that we're keeping everyone safe, that everyone is treated equally. And I think everyone has a role to play in that conversation.
Well, let me ask about the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. I mean, there's a lot in that bill, but the thing that some in law enforcement are upset about is the provision that would curb qualified immunity, which offers legal protections to police officers when citizens seek damages for alleged violations of their constitutional rights. So your vote for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act would eliminate qualified immunity, as far as I understand. Is that what you support? You eliminating qualified immunity?
Well, to me, that wasn't the priority issue in the legislation. Look, no one should have their civil rights violated with impunity. And I think everyone agrees, including law enforcement, that we need greater accountability, more training. And some of the provisions contained within that bill are strong. I think we can get a bipartisan agreement on things like body cameras and banning the use of chokeholds. So I supported a process that I hoped would result in some of these bipartisan changes being enacted into law. Unfortunately, the Senate didn't act and we didn't have the type of conversation that would lead us in that direction. We're seeing it happen in New Hampshire though. And at the state and local level, I think we're seeing some of these changes taking hold. And so I do want to continue to be part of the conversation about reforms that can work, that can keep people safe and ensure that everyone is on equal footing in this country.
What about defunding the police? That's become a rallying cry among some activists who feel public money should be shifted away from traditional policing and toward problems like mental illness and substance abuse, as well as improving education and housing opportunities. Defunding the police, what do you think?
Well, that's not something I support. In fact, I'm the only one in this race who's fighting for more funding for states and municipalities to protect the jobs of members of law enforcement right now. So I'm looking for adequate funding, additional funding, so that we can improve community policing. And in addition to that, I think we have to be serious about the investments we need to make in mental health and addiction and homelessness and in areas in our community where we can provide good services. I've heard so often from law enforcement that the best way you can support me in my job is to make sure there are good social services in place so that someone doesn't need a law enforcement officer to respond to an incident. And I think that's very true. So that's something we're going to be fighting for, hopefully for the next couple of years. And I think we've got to have this kind of community conversation that brings all voices to the table to try to get it right.
What specifically do you think you would like to do in Congress to address systemic racism? Is there a specific policy position that you'd like to take and legislate?
Well, there's a commission that would look at the experience of Black men and boys in this country, and also one that would look at the experience of young Black girls in this country. And I think what we have to do is take a step back. I've been talking to some of the Black activists here in New Hampshire, some who grew up in Manchester just like me, but who had a totally different upbringing than I did and different experiences in the education system. We see disparities in healthcare. I think the institutional racism that exists and persists manifests itself in so many different aspects of our society.
Yeah, and is there an aspect in particular that you think, second term in Congress, this is what you want to accomplish? You want to tackle some element, some specific element of systemic racism, whether it's healthcare, education, housing policy?
Well, I brought up the commission because I think we do need to, take a hard look at what the experiences are of our Black and Brown communities across the country. But I do think healthcare is one area where we need to focus. We have underserved areas here in New Hampshire. And even in a state with a small minority population, we're seeing outsized impacts from COVID on the African-American community, for instance, here in New Hampshire. So I think we have to ensure that everyone has access to healthcare, that it is culturally and socially competent, that it's compassionate care that exists and people have access. So I support additional funding for community health centers, for instance, which can help us fill in some of these gaps and serve populations that might not have access today.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Mark in Conway. Mark, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for your time here. And I want to send out a heartfelt appreciation for everyone who voted. It's tough to, find the time and get out there. I got out and voted. But anyways, moving on. Congressman Pappas, could you address a kind of a little known issue that isn't huge for us in terms of pollution in New Hampshire, but it is relevant? It's the ethanol they're putting in our gasoline. My vehicle, the check engine light came on. And in New Hampshire, you can't get an inspection sticker with a check engine light. And it was just the gas. It was the ethanol in it. And there's a huge pollution problem in the Midwest with this. We don't produce it around here. But it's a national thing where they oblige us to have it in the gas. And President Trump quietly signed in a 15% ethanol thing last summer. Would you like to address this?
Thank you very much, Mark.
Mark, thanks very much for the question. I think this is an issue I don't know a lot about, but I'll say that I know there have been subsidies that exist for years and years to support the ethanol industry. We've suffered from contamination of our water from a different gasoline additive here in New Hampshire, MTBE. And there's still cleanup that has to happen as a result of that. So I think this is an issue I'd like to learn a little bit more about and take a look at. I've been fighting to protect our drinking water here in New Hampshire from PFAS contamination that exists in a lot of our communities. And one of the things I'm looking at is how we can allow EPA to regulate PFAS, which is a known cancer-causing agent and a toxic chemical, under the Clean Water Act. And I think we should look at using our existing environmental protection statutes like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act as ways to protect public health and protect our community. So I'll certainly take a look at that one and see what is on the table already in terms of legislation.
Congressman Pappas, before we let you go, I do want to ask you about the November election, in particular, the voting process and voting by mail and the concerns people are having about the Postal Service. In terms of any outside interference and also the possibility of the Postal Service not being able to do its job with mailed-in ballots, have you spoken with postal workers in the state about recent concerns regarding the Postal Service under Postmaster General Louis DeJoy?
I have spoken with postal workers on several different occasions. And I've been down outside the facility anyway to hear a little bit about what's been going on. And we had four sorting machines disconnected at the Manchester sorting facility. One out of seven sorting machines nationally were disconnected, scrapped, sold off. And it's really just outrageous that we're seeing this happen at this juncture where the Postal Service has never been more crucial to our day-to-day business and also to our ability to make sure that our democracy is functioning come election time. So I think we need a close look at this. I've called for an inspector general investigation into these changes. One of the things that the workers have highlighted for me is, well, once you start disconnecting machines, then you need fewer personnel to run them. You need fewer maintenance people. And so I'm concerned about potential job cuts in the Postal Service that might exacerbate some of the news that we're hearing from our constituents right now about things being slowed down, things like medication delivery being a little bit late. So I think we got to take a close look at this, make sure there's no politics being played with the Postal Service. This is the most popular agency, after all, in our federal government. It's foundational from the very beginning of this country, and we've got to ensure that it's not privatized, that it continues to be there and has the resources it needs to do its job.
Well, Congressman Chris Pappas, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter. Be well.
You too. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. And still to come, NHPR's Sarah Gibson will break down back to school week and all the challenges inherent in education during the pandemic. What's your experience with going back to school? How have your children been handling it? Where's the system falling short for you? Or is it falling short? Maybe it's not. Call us now, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Schools across the state saw students return to the classroom this week. Some of those students were on screens. For a look at how schools handled this unusual back-to-school season, we turn to NHPR's Sarah Gibson. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And listeners, just a reminder, if you have insights into this back-to-school season, maybe your kids went back to school this week, let us know how it went for you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange at nhpr.org. Sarah, most districts reopened this week. How's it going so far from the point of view of parents, kids, teachers? What are you hearing?
A bunch of different things. I mean, as we've said, there are over 170 districts, therefore over 170 plans, and just, thousands of different experiences, obviously, of this past week. I will say that, in spite of a number of hiccups, there is a sense that I've heard among parents as well as school leaders of relief. Like, they've really been in this holding pattern that's been stressful and in some cases very divisive in communities of trying to figure out the best way to reopen. No one is fully satisfied with any of the reopening plans, but for a long time it was kind of a sense of waiting. And now we really are getting a glimpse of what it will feel like to put your kid on a bus after screening them in the morning, or how students are actually doing with masks throughout the day, what it's like to teach social distancing in school, and also what it's like to figure out how to log kids on in and out of Zoom for the whole day if they're doing remote learning. So still a lot of things to figure out in terms of troubleshooting, but I think a lot of people are really happy to finally know what it might look like.
Mm-hmm. And any big surprises, or you mentioned hiccups with reopening so far?
Yeah, I mean, we've heard in a couple of different districts that some of the problems we were hearing early on when schools went remote came back, which was essentially Zoom hacking or Zoom bombing. Students were subjected to lewd images, and in some cases, I'm hearing even pornographic images in areas where they were using Zoom. And it's unclear whether or not the hacking was kind of done internally or externally. Again, this was a problem in the spring, and administrators say they're trying to figure out what's going on. The other thing is, you know, there are positive cases. And in fact, Wyndham High School was supposed to go back to a hybrid model this week, and they had an outbreak which forced them to go remote, to start remote. And as of now, there are 18 students who have tested positive. It's being linked to a large gathering. It's largely student athletes. And that's certainly causing concern, at least among teachers I've spoken with, who say they should not go back to a hybrid model, given the fact that social distancing can't always be maintained in the school building. And given the fact that DHHS is still doing contact tracing to see if there are any more positive cases among parents or students in that school district.
So do school districts have a plan in place for if, like, for example, if they get an outbreak, that triggers, okay, we have to go fully remote now?
Yeah, there are metrics. I mean, these have been developed over the course of months, but they're constantly shifting. And in fact, the state did give pretty clear guidelines for how you move between different reopening models. So say you're in a hybrid model, community transmission is really, really low for a certain amount of time. The public health officials would say this might be time to look at reopening more fully. And then they've also given metrics for what to do if there's a cluster or an outbreak in a school. And certainly public health officials are working hand in hand with administrators in every district in case there is a positive case. As of now, we've been seeing emails that go out from the superintendent to alert people that there has been a positive case identified. And then from there, they determine whether or not there has been any close contact such that more people need to be quarantined. So, you know, there's been a staff member in Fall Mountain. There was also an announcement that an athlete in Manchester tested positive. And so, you know, we're getting these communications and parents are getting those communications, you know, hopefully as quickly as possible, but those decisions about whether or not to close a school or go remote are very much in conjunction with public health officials.
Listeners, we're taking a few moments to speak with NHPR's education reporter, Sarah Gibson, about this unusual back to school season. If you've got questions or have a story about going back to school that you'd like to share, give us a call now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Sarah Gibson, how are districts handling education with the hybrid model so far? How much is being done remotely and in class?
That's a great question. And it varies by district. So for instance, in Hampton, I've heard that the elementary schools, when they have kids at home, when they're not in the school building, they're still very much kind of plugged in and in a regimented schedule where they're signing into their classrooms, they're having kind of virtual connections with their classmates as well as their teachers. And that's with a teacher who's kind of been assigned as the virtual teacher for the remote days for that class. So the idea is for students to really be in class all day, regardless of whether or not they're home or at school. And then there are other places that are allowing the remote days of a hybrid model to be more self-directed and less regimented. And I think for some people, the logic is, look, we don't have teachers to necessarily, or enough staff to, or technology to have a true, you know, 8-to-2 schedule for those kids when they're at home. But some of the logic also, for instance, in Westmoreland, where I was yesterday, is, look, we don't want kids to be looking at a screen all day. So we're going to give them a lot of project-based learning, a lot of to kind of take-home activities to do so they can further their learning from their days in the school building, but have a little bit more freedom to kind of structure their day as they see fit. And just to be clear, particularly with elementary schools and all of these hybrid models, parents really do need to be present, regardless of whether or not they're, you know, signing into Zoom or doing, you know, at-home activities on paper. There's still a lot of oversight that's expected from parents or guardians.
Okay. And how much flexibility is there for families? You mentioned that parents have to be involved. If they prefer to be completely remote, can they be completely remote?
Yeah, I've heard of every district offering a remote option. And that means that if families wanted to commit to being remote for either the first trimester or first semester, they could sign up for remote, and then either they would enroll in VLACS, which is the Virtual Learning Academy Charter School, which the state pays for, and they would learn virtually that way, or they would be assigned to virtual teachers who, you know, maybe are teachers in the district who stayed at home for the semester to teach kids who are staying remote. Or in some cases, they're actually kind of being beamed into the classrooms that those kids' classmates are in. So they'll kind of be projected onto a wall and almost participate at the same time as their classmates, but just not be in the building. So there are various remote options that have been given to families with the understanding that, you know, because of health and safety concerns, as well as underlying conditions of that student or their family members, it might actually be necessary for them to be home for the whole semester.
And the state's largest districts are staying remote at least for this month. What are you hearing from those districts?
So Concord, Nashua, and Manchester, they have all stayed remote with the, as you were saying, intention to try out hybrid. And I'm hearing so far that there are a lot of logistics to be figured out, but that people are kind of getting into a routine with remote. I think the concern with this shift in schedule is that it takes so long to develop routine. And if you are just finally settling into a routine of what it's like to be virtual for a month, and then you go to hybrid, that's going to take a number of weeks to establish that new routine and kind of troubleshoot all of the problems that come up with bringing more students back into the school building. So I have heard some concern from parents that, you know, we want consistency for the duration of the semester. And that's a hard thing to balance with also the desire of parents and students to get back into the building. So that's certainly on the minds of school boards and school leaders as they try to figure out how to balance, you know, the remote model now with a desire and goal of a hybrid model later on this fall.
One last question before we let you go, Sarah Gibson. Governor Sununu had taken heat from his Democratic primary opponents for neglecting to give schools enough guidance, in their words. But he did issue some guidance this summer. With the election coming up, what are the political implications of this reopening debate?
Well, you know, some people would say school reopening should not be political, but it totally is. I mean, the coronavirus pandemic and how it's being handled by lawmakers, by governors, by President Trump, that is a political question. It's very much on the ballot. And so we're certainly seeing among Democrats and many teachers' unions a concern about funding, saying, you know, we'd like to be back in school, but there are not enough resources nor enough funding to ensure that we can do that safely. And that's a reflection of a failure of leadership, they say, both at the state level as well as the national level. And then we have others who, you know, maybe have already been critical of growing school budgets, taxpayers who are concerned about kind of what they see as the bureaucracy of the school system that limits parents' choices and that prioritizes teachers over students. And they say this is yet another example of, Democrats and school bureaucracy and teachers unions kind of calling the shots rather than parents getting the opportunity to send their kids back into the school system. So it certainly has political dimensions. And in some towns, it has become really divisive and has kind of reified existing political divisions. And again, it varies by district. I certainly hear of towns and communities coming together around the reopening plans. But I think we'll certainly see these called out in political debates in the months to come.
Well, we'll certainly be following this with you in the months to come. Thank you very much, Sarah Gibson. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's NHPR's education reporter, Sarah Gibson. And speaking of politics, let's turn now to the primary election, the big news this week. Tuesday night saw the resolution of a few heated primary battles among candidates of both major parties. And for more insight on this, we're going to turn to Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. Welcome, Ethan. Ethan DeWitt, are you with us? While we work on getting Ethan DeWitt on the line, here are some of the stories that NHPR's newsroom has been following this week. Nashua Mayor Jim Donches and two others at Nashua City Hall have tested positive for COVID-19. Officials maintain that there is no outbreak at City Hall at this time. Donches and the others who tested positive are self-isolating at home for 10 days, and the city's public health department is notifying others who might be affected. Also, more than 50,000 people in New Hampshire have received unemployment support through the federal Lost Wages Supplement Payment Program. Governor Chris Sununu says the state was able to accelerate the $300 weekly payments through an emergency order. A Republican stimulus proposal that included further unemployment benefits failed to pass yesterday in Washington. And VLAX, the state's virtual charter school, as NHPR's Sarah Gibson just mentioned, is receiving $7 million in CARES Act funding. Interest in the school has increased dramatically during the pandemic. Currently, there are more than 3,000 students in VLAX. The state is using the new funding to hire more teachers. Governor Sununu says this could open up access to thousands of students currently on the VLAX wait list. Let's turn now again to Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. Ethan, are you there?
I'm here. Happy to be here.
Great. Yes, we certainly can. Thank you very much for being here.
Great.
And thanks for giving us your insights on the primary. That was a big day here in New Hampshire news. One of the most closely watched races was the Democratic primary for governor, where State Senator Dan Feltes and Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky were battling for that nomination. Dan Feltes emerged victorious. Break down that race for us. How did it go?
Sure. So this was kind of a fascinating one to watch as a reporter for a number of levels. So these two men, Senator Feltes and Executive Counselor Walensky, they're kind of prominent in their respective political chambers on the state Senate or the Executive Council. But in a lot of ways, on paper, they were kind of united on a lot of issues. They supported, a lot of kind of traditional Democratic points, such as the increasing the state minimum wage to $15 an hour, expanding solar energy, marijuana legalization, abortion rights, gun control, making increased investments to schools and to the state's Medicaid program. So in a lot of areas, and you could see this in debates, it was a little bit hard to distinguish them. There were some major exceptions. The Councilor Walensky notably refused to signed the pledge, the traditional vow by officials in New Hampshire and both parties that they will not support, if elected to governor, a broad-based tax, broad-based sales or income tax.
And this was a risky position, right? Right, Ethan? Because traditionally, those who have refused to take the pledge have not prevailed.
Right. And what was interesting about the position by Walensky is that this was a position early on in his candidacy. But as we saw his candidacy kind of grow, mature through the summer months, he sort of really leaned into it. And his argument that he was making is that it's all about property taxes. And he was making kind of an advanced version of an argument that Democrats in the state have been trying to make for years, which is that property taxes have been rising even while, there is no sales or income tax, that people's property taxes that they pay through either rent or through owning a home have gone up. And that's because of a lack of state investment. So Andy Walensky really leaned into that to the extent to which you saw signs all over the state that had giant cartoon scissors cutting in half property taxes. Well, the second part of that pledge to kind of cut property taxes was an implicit restructuring of the tax system that would mean more taxes elsewhere. So what Andy did, what Councilor Walensky did is he kind of turned on its head this usually third rail argument for a broad-based tax and tried to make it an argument against property taxes. And his pitch was, we already have a broad-based tax with property taxes. So it was really interesting to watch as a reporter, because you don't normally see this argument at all on a gubernatorial stage. But you definitely don't usually see it in this kind of advanced form. And, you know, for a candidate to get within 5 percentage points of the vote of winning is kind of remarkable, and potentially a statement on where the Democratic Party might be amenable to going in the years ahead. But of course, the voters ultimately chose Feltis.
Okay, so tell us about what Dan Feltis will be running on as we head into the general.
Yeah, so there's three things that, as I look at it, that Feltis is going to have to try to do. And first off, just to note, this is something that was kind of illustrated by the pandemic and we've been following primaries. But New Hampshire is one of the latest state primaries in the country. It's, I believe, the second latest or third latest of any state. And that makes it very hard for any challenger of any party to challenge an incumbent governor. They only have about 2 months, and there's usually a big disadvantage in name recognition. So that's the number one thing that Feltis has to try to do, is try to boost that name recognition.
Did he have a problem with name recognition? Oh, sorry to interrupt, Ethan, but did he have as much of a problem with name recognition? I mean, he was pretty prominent even in during the primary as in the state Senate advocating for things like paid family leave. He was out in front of microphones fairly frequently.
He was, but in a state like New Hampshire, I mean, there is a sort of bubble that you get into when you're in Concord and you assume everyone's kind of following this. Polls have shown that obviously Governor Sununu, who has a much more storied political last name, has a distinct advantage there. There was also some analysis that kind of came in after that the governor's campaign, Governor Sununu's campaign, was touting, that suggested that there were a fair number of people who actually voted who wrote in Sununu on a Democratic ballot. So they voted a Democratic ballot, but then they kind of wrote in Sununu, whether as a protest vote or whatever. So there is certainly an advantage that the governor has that Feltis will have to chip away at. So that's his number one thing. The one thing he's tried to do since the beginning of his candidacy is tie Sununu to Trump. And, you know, he's hoping that as this particular cycle focuses on as a referendum on Trump, which you didn't really get on the presidential ballot, in 2018, Feltis is trying to kind of make that argument. And then he has kind of a difficult case to make. He has a pre-pandemic case, and these are kind of the positions he was running on before. This would be like the minimum wage, energy, clean energy policy, that kind of thing. But now we're in a very different environment. So Feltis is going to have to try to convince voters that he would be the better governor to lead during this pandemic and during this economic situation where we're going to lose quite a lot of state revenue and have to make some tough choices. So it's a lot to do in 2 months. And so he is, you saw this week, he's quickly trying to get kind of the Valinsky side of the party, some of the more progressive side of the party on board, and try to double down and bring the fight to Sununu.
Okay. And what about Governor Sununu? Is he highlighting things like his record on COVID-19 or on other things as he gears up for the general election?
Yeah. So Sununu, like Feltis, has a few things to juggle as well. He obviously has his base, his political base, and I think the pitch that he's been making is quite simple. He's kind of touting the vetoes that he's issued, and he's saying, I'm the last defense against the Democratic legislature for Republicans who don't like some of these initiatives that have been coming through the last 2 years. And so he's definitely going to lock down that message, and attempt to lock down that message. He's also, though, from his base, had an interesting threat in the last few months that's unique to the pandemic. His decision to shut down large areas of the state's economy by deciding which businesses were essential and non-essential, that kind of created a separate little growth within the Republican Party that kind of goes under the label Reopen New Hampshire. And this is a constituency that I'm watching carefully. They came out with a press release this week, and they claim to have successfully endorsed 101 House candidates who have won their primaries and are now moving on as their nominees. And this coalition has held rallies outside the state house. They've made no you know, they haven't tried to hide their disdain for Sununu's actions. And they even backed a challenger to Sununu, Karen Testerman, who didn't do so well in the primary, but does represent kind of a dissatisfaction by a small part of the Republican Party. So Sununu has to kind of both, you know, pitch to regular Republican voters that he's going to stop Democratic initiatives, and he's going to have to try to neutralize that threat and try to bring that party together where you have a lot of dissatisfaction. And then he has to make the pitch to the middle, to independents, and that's kind of the, you know, where governorships are won and lost in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And in the, on that, he's going to try to make a case about management and why he needs to stay on top of the management of this pandemic.
And Sununu also got the endorsement of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire this week. How big a deal is that?
Well, it's hard to tell with endorsements, but it certainly kind of demonstrates that, you know, he's consolidating in a lot of ways some of the central pieces of the response to the coronavirus, but not all of them. The New Hampshire Troopers Association has endorsed Dan Feltis this week as well, and they are citing this contractual dispute that has played out between the state employee unions and the governor. So it's kind of a mixed bag so far for both candidates moving ahead.
Okay. Well, let's look at some of the other races on the ballot that may have received less attention but are still important. How about the executive council and the seat left open by Andrew Valinsky? Who won that?
Sure. So that was a really crowded race and kind of an interesting one because it's rare that you see this much attention on an executive council race. And this is kind of, it was largely a result of just having an open seat. This seat has been kind of district, the way that the district lines were drawn, many would argue it has been gerrymandered to become an extremely safe Democratic seat. It spans from Vermont to Maine, but it kind of cuts through all these progressive towns like Keene and Concord and Portsmouth. And so it's in a lot of ways a safe seat. So the fight for that seat kind of plays out in the primary. And you had a very crowded field of six candidates. The candidate who won, Cindy Warmington, she leaned in on her healthcare experience. She is a lawyer attorney at Shaheen and Gordon. She's represented providers throughout her career, healthcare providers. And so she made the pitch that this is the time to have healthcare experience on the executive council. Warmington also has ties to the Democratic Party. She's an official within the Democratic Party and was able to rack up endorsements. Her closest competitor, Leah Plunkett, ran on an association with Planned Parenthood, which endorsed her and kind of reproductive rights in general, and also was part of a kind of coalition that we saw around the state of younger, female candidates, usually moms who kind of ran on their appeal as a working mother. But in the end, voters kind of went for the for Warmington and kind of the healthcare background.
Okay. And how about the state Senate and Dan Feltis's seat?
Sure. So that was another kind of area that fits into some of the trend of where some of the down ballot races were going for younger kind of female progressive candidates. So Becky Whitley, who has not ever run for office, this is her first run. She took that nomination and her closest competitor was Paul Hodes. Hodes, who was a former congressman for the second congressional district and is well known around the area. So it kind of came down to where the party is going, the Democratic Party, and Hodes was making an appeal to people who had known him in the past and his experience in Washington and experience working alongside the Obama administration. And Whitley was making kind of a fresher argument of how we need a fresher face. And interestingly, to Valinsky's point, Whitley, I interviewed her and I asked her about the idea of the pledge and this kind of vow not to, add a sales tax or an income tax. And Whitley would also not take the pledge. She said that she would be open to a broad-based tax. And she said that now is the time during this pandemic to consider that. And so I think that also speaks to the legacy that Zelensky was talking to me about the day that he conceded this week, which is that he was hoping to kind of open the door a little bit more for the Democratic Party to consider what was once an anathema idea, like, you know, considering a broad-based income tax and restructuring the whole way that education is set up. So we'll see how that kind of plays out in the general election and how much you kind of hear those ideas being thrown about. But it was an interesting thing in that race.
Well, Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. You can find links to his reporting and all the stories we've been talking about today at nhpr.org. And still to come, former New Hampshire Governor Steve Merrill died last weekend. We'll look back at his life and legacy and give us a call or send us an email if you have a memory of him that you'd like to share. We'll see if we can get it on the air today. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Former New Hampshire Governor Steve Merrill was known for his fiscally conservative politics and his outgoing personality. He died this past weekend at the age of 74. The two-term governor was credited with coining the phrase New Hampshire Advantage to describe the state's tax structure and approach to politics. With me now for insights into his life and legacy is Steve Dupree, prominent Republican leader and former state Republican Party chair. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
I'm happy to be here, Peter.
So in what capacity did you know former Governor Merrill? Was it personal as well as professional?
Oh, yes, personal. First, I met him as a lawyer. He was in a large law firm that my wife was in, so I met him there. And then we really had our first close contact when I ran for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District primary in 1992, and he decided to run for governor. He'd never been in a political campaign. I'd been in a number of them and run a number of them for senators and congressmen in New Hampshire. So I engaged a pollster and an ad person. And a week after Steve got in the race, he said, "Hey, I need a pollster and ad person. Will you share yours?" Usually you had exclusive contracts, but I did. And we kidded each other that whoever won, the loser, if they lost their primary, had to be the finance chair or campaign chair for the other. He did much better than I did. I came in a second. He won the primary in less than 4 hours after my race was declared. At 5 o'clock in the morning, he called me up and he said, "Well, you have to make good on the bet." So I became his finance chair, and John Stabile was his campaign chair. And that's when we really developed a friendship, although I'd known him as a trial lawyer. And then he asked me, he told me my punishment for him having won the governorship was that I had to be the Republican Party chair, which I did under both of his terms.
Sounds like a blend of that outgoing personality and his politics that we've been hearing so much about.
Yes, people forget he was a brilliant trial lawyer, and the essence of a good trial lawyer is somebody who can take a very complicated argument and reduce it to a simple concept that people understand. And I know a lot of people have talked about he coined that sort of penumbra of things that we love about New Hampshire into the phrase, the New Hampshire Advantage.
Some Democrats who opposed him called him the best politician they've ever seen. That's according to reporting by the Concord Monitor. So what do you think made him such a good politician? Was it simply his skills as a lawyer, or was there something else?
No, he had the best sense of humor of any governor I've known, and I have known and worked with every governor since Walter Peterson. He had great humility, but he had a terrific sense of humor. And even in a serious situation, he could tell a story or a joke that put people immediately at ease. And when he was campaigning, it was the same way. He would start off with a self-deprecating joke, and people would laugh at him or with him, and then he'd go from there. And that's why Arne Arnesen, who took him on, said he was just fabulous at retail politics. He also could be very serious when the situation demanded it, and he was a very good leader, but people liked him because he had great humility. He was a New Hampshire guy through and through. He had an incredible level of knowledge of everything about every town in New Hampshire, and he was just very likable.
So what do you think his greatest political achievement is?
Well, I think there were two. That coining of the phrase New Hampshire Advantage, which I think to people who are natives or who have lived here a long time believe in, and it certainly has been a cornerstone of the Republican philosophy of limited government, not having a broad-based tax, having a responsive government, I think he'll be known for that. He had some challenging economic times. Passing the business enterprise tax was controversial for a governor to do, but he cast it very successfully as a fairness argument that every business should pay some tax, not just a few. And I also think he showed great leadership when his party probably wasn't firmly behind him declaring a Martin Luther King Day until we got the law changed. And as he said, as Martin Luther King used to say, it's always the right time to do the right thing. That was great leadership.
And that he did that by executive order before they
were. Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wasn't willing to wait for a legislature that he thought might balk. He also could be, when he was engaged with the legislature, he could have some great battles with the other side, but could disagree without being disagreeable, which seems to be, unfortunately, a lost art.
Well, Steve Dupree, former state Republican Party chair, thanks for spending some time helping us remember former Governor Steve Merrill. We really appreciate it.
He was a great guy, and he's gone too soon. We were lucky to have him here in New Hampshire. I will miss him a lot.
Thanks again. And listeners, if you're curious about learning more about Steve Merrill, we've got links to our remembrances of him at our website, nhpr.org. And that's the roundup for this week. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program director. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Jane Vaughn is production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.